The coronavirus situation has shown a mistake that I apparently have been making for a while. Because we're not allowed to go outside, a lot of my friends have decided that we would meet over things like Skype and Zoom. And as some of you might know, a few years ago, I moved from the Netherlands to Canada. So a lot of my friends are still back in the Netherlands. And this situation has actually meant that I, for the first time in a long time, spoke to these friends of mine through Zoom, and I had a really good time. And what it showed me was how much fun and how easy it is to keep up with friends from back home, but also friends from here. So whether this is going to take a long time or not, I'm going to try and keep up and stay in contact with my friends a lot more, whether that is in person or online. You are listening to the Imperfect Athlete Podcast, my show about the power of mistakes. My guest today is Samuel Pedlow. He's a professional Canadian beach volleyball athlete who competes with his partner Sam Schechter on the FIVB, the International Volleyball Association Beach Volleyball World Tour. As an athlete, Sam is known for his tremendous work ethic and competitiveness. However, a lot of people might know him from his social media presence, where he gives a great insight into the life of a professional athlete. I'm very pleased to have him on the show, so let's dive straight into it. Hi Sam, how are you doing?
Not so bad, how about yourself?
I am hanging in there. Everything, of course, is a little bit different. However, I'm planning this podcast to remain as corona free as possible, just because I feel like my life is already kind of consumed by it. All the news I read and everything, when I talk to people, it's about that. So I felt like maybe having one outlet where I don't talk about it, and maybe people who are listening also don't have to listen to it, might be a refreshing change.
I think that's a great idea.
So I guess let's dive straight into it. Could you explain to me a little bit how you got started playing volleyball?
Yeah, so I mean, I think my entry to volleyball, you know, it's not a unique story. It's probably similar to what a lot of the youth in Ontario and Canada and around the world go through in order to get introduced to the sport. For me, you know, my parents and my parents' friends, they were always playing volleyball at our cottage. And I think it was something I was always around, something I was always seeing, especially in the summer months. And, you know, it obviously piqued my interest. I think everyone at a young age, you know, they see their parents playing and they want to be like them, no matter what sport it could be. And, you know, we travel around to different areas, different recreational tournaments, and my parents would be playing with their friends, and that's how I met my friends. And then through that, we started to, you know, experiment with the game on our own time. Obviously, you become, you know, when I was a youth, there, volleyball wasn't really accessible until you were in grade 7, grade 8. So, you know, I would say around grade 5 or grade 6 is when I started to, you know, pick up the ball more frequently, be asking my dad if he wants to, you know, help me out, and you know, asking my friends if they want to play volleyball. It wasn't very popular back then, but, you know, it was something that definitely piqued my interest. And, you know, through there, I was trying out for my local club team when I was of the appropriate age, you know, playing for my school team, and then entering into, you know, the Ontario Volleyball Association. And you know, that's where volleyball became structured for me. It wasn't so much free play, but, you know, that's where I was involved in, you know, the Canadian volleyball system. Played recreational for that club team in Barrie, and until I graduated high school. You know, I ultimately ended up at Queen's University, which I think is where like my volleyball journey started to become much more serious. I was always a multi-sport athlete prior to that. I say this all the time, and to everyone who will listen, I was pretty terrible at volleyball for a really long time. You know, even entering Queen's, I wasn't very good. I had a lot of potential, but by no means was I anyone knew. I was just a, you know, 6'6" tall, skinny kid. And thankfully, Brenda saw something in me and decided to put the work in. And it was a lot of work. And, you know, by my fifth year, I was a fairly respectable player. Our team had a ton of success, but, you know, that's where I thought really my volleyball journey ended. I did my master's at Western University in physical therapy and, you know, started to get asked more and more to come out to the beach. I'd always played beach in the summer, but, you know, nothing more than the local circuit. And, you know, following those 2 years after my master's was kind of, you know, where the fire was reignited. I felt like I'd matured enough both physically and mentally to be able to, you know, take the sport to the next level for myself. And, you know, that's when I started playing internationally for Canada. Was 2012 was my first tournament. And since then, it's just been one heck of a journey. I think I'm at over 100 tournaments representing Canada now. Been ranked in the top 20 in the world pretty consistently for the last 4 or 5 years. And yeah, now it's my full-time job.
Yeah, it's an interesting story how it kind of, you know, at some point it suddenly almost exponentially grew to be something more than just, you know, playing. But I'm actually really interested. You mentioned sort of experimenting when you were younger. There was no structure. Like, what did that look like?
So I used to have, not used to, I have a friend, who my dad and his father were best friends, and they would play at the cottage all the time. They'd play sixes, beach sixes. And, we weren't allowed to play because we weren't good enough. So we would pepper, but you can only pepper for so long before you get bored, right? So we would come up with all these crazy volleyball games that it's not even volleyball, but it was, you know, you'd throw a ball up in the air, bounce, and then we'd draw lines in the grass and you would have to joust each other. And whoever the ball landed on that side, 1 point. And we'd play to like 21. We'd play these other games where it'd have to go off a roof and you get one bounce and all these crazy iterations of ball control. But we weren't looking at it like, oh, this is making us better at volleyball. We were like, this is just a way that we can play volleyball, just the two of us. No structure to it, no set plan, but we'd play for 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day. And then there were summers where we didn't play volleyball at all. We decided we wanted to build a tree fort. So we would spend 6 or 7 hours a day building a tree fort. We thought we were going to be professional tennis players. So one summer we rented all these movies to learn how to play tennis, and we would play tennis all day, every day. So in my mind, those years for me were more about, you know, movement exploration and, you know, trying to adapt to all of these different challenges. And as a result, him and I ended up being very good at a lot of different sports. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, you know, I was 18 that I decided volleyball was going to be my one specific thing. But I think just that age and growing up, it just introduced me to like the love of sport itself.
Mm, and movement, because I think that's what you do in your job as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges of the youth right now, right? Is that sports specialization. And I mean, that's a whole topic to dive into in itself, but I'm one of those athletes who grew up as a generalist, not as a specialist. Mm.
Yeah. And there's actually a lot of research that states that is probably the way we would like athletes to go rather than specialize earlier, for career longevity and even, quality in the end.
Exactly.
What I think what's really interesting about that in terms of, if you look at, you know, playing in organized sports and playing balls off a roof with bounces with your friend, is, you know, this whole show is about what mistakes do you make and how do you learn from that and how do you change what you do. If you play on organized sports, you can make as many mistakes as you want. There is no coach. There is no opponent. I mean, yes, you're playing, I guess you're playing a game against your friend, but there's no real consequence for winning and losing. There's nobody that tells you how you should do it, which means that you can do, I mean, basically anything you want. And I've seen this a lot. I think it's a similarity between a lot of athletes is those kinds of just creative games of just playing whatever is a really good predictor of how good people actually are going to get at some point, which is a little bit bittersweet because as somebody who would, you know, like to develop talent and stuff like that, it's you can't organize it because the moment you organize it, it loses its actual value in that way. So I know that volleyball is relatively small sport. Now, obviously, I know a lot about it, and I'm very invested in it because, well, it's my sport. But I think beach volleyball, women volleyball, might be an even smaller group of people. So could you explain to the people who are listening and maybe are not as familiar with beach volleyball what your role as a blocker in beach volleyball is?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's the biggest difference with, you know, beach volleyball and indoor volleyball. Even when you say something like blocker, defender, and, you know, if we're using nomenclature for indoor volleyball, you think of like middle, right side, left side, right? You know, when you think indoor, middle, left side, right side, to me, that's a specialist. That's that they are in the same position on the court. They're switching into that position as soon as they can. And then from there, that's home base and they operate. And, you know, and I think when you think beach volleyball blocker defender, it can be easy to have that same assumption, but it's the furthest from the truth. Although I'm labeled as a blocker, yes, blocker is my specialty. I have to be a generalist to be successful in beach volleyball. If I can't, you know, I still have to pass. I still have to set, I still have to serve, I still have to block, and in certain situations, I still have to defend. So the demands or the skill requirement for any one individual player, whether they're a blocker or a defender, is so vast. And, you know, as a blocker, my role is that I'm at the net as often as I possibly can be. There are unique situations where I'm not able to get to the net, and it makes more sense for the other player to be at the net. But in general, I'm serving, I'm running to the net, and I'm the first line of defense against the opponent. Blockers are typically taller. They're typically heavier. They're typically the more powerful of the two players. Obviously, there's exceptions to that rule. But in general, that's the way it is. You think of the blocker typically more as the sledgehammer. They're kind of the power of the team, and the defender is more of that crafty chisel. You know, they're more cognitive in the way that they play the game, sometimes less physical. Again, always exceptions. In my case, my defender is actually taller than me, although when we stood side by side, you wouldn't think it. It's an interesting optical illusion, but yes, I'm actually shorter than my partner. But yeah, it's super interesting because, you know, beach volleyball, we think that it's a team sport. There's two of us, but, you know, unlike, indoor volleyball, you can single a player out exclusively in the sport of beach volleyball in the sense that, you know, if I'm receiving serve, there's a very high likelihood that I will also be the one attacking versus indoor volleyball. The person who receives the serve, you know, there's still four, five, sometimes other options, or I guess there's at least four other options for the person to attack the ball. So we're a team sport with a partner, but, you know, when push comes to shove, you're sometimes out there by yourself. Your partner can help you out and they can do everything they can, but it's not the same as, you know, other sports where, you know, especially in indoor, right? You think of the right side taking over. It's the fifth set, end of the game. Where's the ball going? It's going to your leading your leading point generator, whereas in beach volleyball, it's like the ball's coming back to you no matter what. So
yeah, and would you say that that's maybe something that people that people don't understand, is that beach volleyball is almost like it's an individual sport. You play with somebody else.
Yeah, I really don't think that. I mean, from a physical perspective, I think they understand that you're going to be running around in sand, you're going to be moving around a lot, but I don't think that that's something they understand necessarily from the mental perspective, and which differs from other sports. It's like, you know, at the end of the game, you might just crack because the pressure on you is too much, not the pressure of the situation, but it's just you. You're out there. You have to receive. You have to side out. You can't rely on, you know, an indoor, a libero taking extra court to take off the pressure of you, right? I mean, we have our partner, but your partner can't crowd the whole court, right? So it's an interesting cognitive demand that I don't think people really understand. And that's why you see, you know, teams will be down by a point 19-20, and then they'll win 22-20, because just kind of that cognitive collapse will happen, and boom, the other team can just ramp right up and steal that set. It happens every day on the FIVB World Tour.
So, taking that into account, right, the differences, also the fact that in beach volleyball you don't have substitutions, there's no out. If you know that you are targeted, you have to do it. Can you remember a time where kind of that realization hit for you mentally, where you're like, and kind of you accepted the fact that that would, you know, be very uncomfortable, but, you know, when was that mistake that made you think, oh, that's how it works?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always kind of the old saying, like, get comfortable being uncomfortable. And, like, you know, was there a point where, you know, that just kind of clicked, where I was like, you know what, this, you know, I'm out here and I'm comfortable, I'm content with what I'm doing, I don't feel the pressure. You know, was there a moment that happened? Like, no. Am I definitely better at it? For sure. But it's, you know, that I think that discomfort, so much of it is self-created or self-manifested. And it's because of pressure. You know, we put ourselves in these environments and we build them up to be sometimes more than they are, and it feels at the time like it's the most important thing that will ever happen to you, and the last thing you want to do is lose in that situation. And you know, by diving into that mindset, I think sometimes you can build the situation up and build the situation up and build it up until you're almost putting yourself in a scenario where you're more likely to, you know, succumb to the pressure instead of rise to it. And I think when you start to accept that, you know, these situations are built up because of something that you've created, and that really at the end of the day, most of the time, none of this matters. You start to become comfortable in that situation and actually begin to enjoy it on a completely different level. You know, I think back, I played for Queens for 5 years, Queens University, and we made the OUA finals five times. And in my fourth and fifth year, I was a starter. And I remember being so incredibly nervous before those games and so incredibly nervous during those games. And it was because at the time I thought, this is the most important athletic thing I've ever done in my life. And it will be the most important athletic thing that will ever happen in my life. And it's so interesting now looking back, like I graduated 10 years ago this year. So 10 years ago, I won my last OUA championship. And like looking back on it now, it was an important moment at the time, but also so insignificant across the greater scheme of my life. And I put that moment above so much and put so much pressure on that moment that I don't think I was ever really able to enjoy playing volleyball at that level. And looking back on it, it's so interesting because it was one of the greatest, like one of the greatest 5 years of my life. Like Queens was an unbelievable experience. But it wasn't an unbelievable experience because I enjoyed playing volleyball. It was everything about it. And I think if I was able to step back, take some of that pressure off of myself and just, you know, be able to play free, I think that experience could have been even heightened. And I think that that's the case with so many different athletic experiences, whether it be, you know, you think of a 16-year-old kid going to a provincial championship or an 18-year-old kid saying, you know, this is my last Canadian Nationals. And, you know, the amount of pressure they're putting on themselves to win, you know, a Canadian National Championship. And it's like, I've never won a Canadian National Championship in indoor. I've never won one in beach. I've only ever won one provincial championship in beach. But we're putting so much pressure on these insignificant moments that sometimes we lose perspective and what they mean in the greater scheme of our sports journey.
Yeah, we call this the concept of framing, kind of like how, where do you put the frame around a certain event? And it's really interesting. You show when we have a too small of a frame, we're like, oh, this is everything. This experience, this moment is everything. It's the most important thing. And it's a really small frame, and it leads to people feeling, you know, a lot of pressure and stuff like that. And then the other hand, what I see sometimes as well, when people get to a situation like that, they make the frame way too big. It's like, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You know, we're all just specks of dust in the universe kind of idea. They don't realize that the right frame is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you can be so broad. I mean, you know, when I say things like, you know, ultimately it doesn't matter. It's like, it does. It does in the sense that you've trained hard. You've put yourself in a position to, you know, achieve the goal you've probably set out for yourself. But like you said, what happens is, in my mind, saying those things are, I tend to frame it too small. So by saying those things, I think it allows me to expand my frame beyond that tunnel vision, which gives me comfort. And maybe somebody whose frame is too large, they're trying to, you know, hype up the importance of an event in order to try and bring their frame down a little bit. And I think it really depends, you know, on the person, because I think we've all had those teammates that said, you know, it appears like none of this matters, nothing phases them, but they're able to continue to go out and put out peak performances, right? And I think there's also, we've had teammates who they've said, yeah, this is the most important thing in the world for me right now. Their frame is really small, but then they throw out these peak performances over and over. I just think, you know, as myself, who's someone whose frame is often too small, I think what people don't often appreciate is the cognitive, the mental, emotional load that having a frame that's too small can take. Because if you're constantly looking at that as being, you know, hyper important, and you're putting that pressure on yourself, if you don't have the tools to deal with that, it can become overwhelming and then ultimately start to affect your performance in a negative way.
Hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just wanted to take a quick moment to remind you of two little things. First of all, this is only the first part of my conversation with Sam. Don't worry, the episode isn't over yet, but the second part of our conversation, talking about some of the things that he posted on his website and how he's growing as an athlete, will be up in 2 weeks. Second of all, I'm using a lot of the time at home that I have now to create a lot of content. If you're interested in my new blog, YouTube videos, and all the other content I make, go to jwkmentalperformance.com to check it out. Now, let's get back to the episode. Your job is to travel with the beach tour. You know, you can call it a circus or whatever you want to call it. What are the difficulties of working in such an environment that is constantly traveling, constantly changing? Like, what do you find are the biggest hurdles that you have to overcome to be effective in that environment?
Well, I think you said it right there. One is travel. You have to be adaptable. If you think about the average person, you know, they're maybe taking 3-4 flights a year. You think of someone who's like a quote unquote world traveler, they might be taking 10 flights a year. Well, I'm taking 100 different planes a year. So, you know, if statistically a few of those are going to go wrong, right? And in my business, if the later you show up, the more your performance is potentially going to struggle. So if you're missing a connection, or you go deeper in the tournament than you expected, you might be showing up later to the next tournament. And depending on where the time zones are, you could be losing an entire day just because of traveling back and forth across the world. You show up to tournaments and there's a hurricane and the tournament is bumped back an entire day. So now instead of playing a tournament in 4 days, you have to play a tournament in 3 days. So there's thousands of examples of these changes that happen that you have to be adaptable to. And if you're not able to have that adaptable mindset, it's really, really, really challenging and can throw off your entire tournament. And, you know, you just flew from, say, Austria to Tokyo, and, you know, you can't just wipe the slate clean and be like, All right, that week's done, move on to the next one, because there's only so many opportunities. I think as you get older and more mature, you're able to, you know, roll with the punches a little bit better, because you've been through these experiences and you've developed these tools so that no matter the situation, you can go out and, you know, put out a consistent performance. But I know when I was younger, the first tournament I ever went to in 2012 with Grant O'Gorman, we went to Puerto Rico and a hurricane went through, and we got there on a Wednesday and the hurricane stopped on Saturday, and we played an entire tournament in one day. It was our first international tournament ever. We got third and flew home, and it's what it was. We have no say in how the tournament changed. The courts were completely flooded. We were playing in like ankle deep water. And this was like my first experience as being a professional beach volleyball player. And I was like, well, you know what? It can't really get any tougher than that. So it's one of those things that you have to be an adaptable individual, because there's so many different problems that are going to be thrown at you. And if you let that affect you on the court, it's not going to do anything but, you know, deteriorate your performance.
Is that something you felt like you had to learn to roll with the punches and be adaptable, or is it something you were naturally good at?
No, for sure. I'm definitely a control freak. I very much thrive in structure. I like to have a plan. I like to stick to that plan and execute. And I think I'm definitely getting much better at adapting and being comfortable being comfortable when I'm uncomfortable. But it's not something that I was like growing up that I was good with. I think the reason I like structure so much is because it gives me it makes situations predictable for me. You know, like even in, you know, coronavirus, I'm still making a schedule and sticking to that schedule because it gives me comfort. And like, I know what I need to do. And even though I don't necessarily want to work out, it's like, no, today's like workout at this time. I have to do it. I have the discipline to be able to do that. But especially, you know, on the world tour, I was fairly young starting out. My partner was very young. He was only 18. So we really had to mature together in order to, you know, be more comfortable in those situations that we had no control over. The FIVB changing the structure of a tournament when you get there. Like, people don't think these things happen, but they do. They'll change the tournament structure to double elimination. They'll, you know, tell you, you know, we were just in Qatar before all of the lockdowns. There, you know, there's rumors floating around that there'll be no Olympic points for this tournament. They're going to cut the money in half, like all of these things. And you know, you're thinking, well, this is like my livelihood, this is my income. You know, I just flew from Canada to Qatar, which is the furthest flight. It's further to fly to Qatar than to China. So people don't realize that flying to the Middle East is, it's a real mission. It's a long flight. And to get there and then be like, well, you know what, we're not going to pay you. It's, you know, you can't let that phase you on the court, because, you know, that's what you've been training so hard for.
So how does control freak Sam, I guess, distance those things that happen off the court from what happens on the court?
I think the biggest thing is understanding a lot of it is out of your control. When you're able to kind of let go of that control piece, it's definitely a weight off your mind. It's very freeing. There's certain things you can control. And, you know, often in high performance athletes, they've controlled what they can control. Usually the things that they can control aren't the things that are going wrong, because they've taken the time to create this schedule or this plan that works very effectively for them. So it's difficult for them to, especially myself, to just accept, you know, these changes. But I think once you accept that, you know, you really have no control over the situation, you know, then you can figure out, okay, well, how can I make the best out of the situation? A lot of cases it's, well, how can we still bring our best performance? You know, your game got moved up for like 3 hours, or because the court was running behind, so they switched courts and they put you on a new court, and it's like, well, you haven't eaten or done any of this, and you know, you don't have control that your game got switched. So how do you make the best out of the situation right now? And I think, you know, for me especially, you know, I have an anchor for myself that I'm always going to bring 100% effort any chance I have to touch the ball, and I know I'll never break that commitment to myself. So whatever changes, whatever it might be, you know, whether I was able to eat or not eat, or brought the wrong shorts, or forgot my sunglasses, I know when I step on that court, I'm going to bring 100% effort. And that might change day to day based on, you know, physiology, mental preparedness, whatever it might be. But on that day, at that time, I'm going to give it my best. So I think by just understanding that there's certain things you can't control, and it is a waste of energy, it's a waste of resources to try and create structure in that environment when you don't have control, and just go out and do what you've trained to do at the best that you can at that particular moment.
So now we are, let's say we're, I guess, like 2 or 3 hours out from a match, you're at the tournament. How do you prepare for a game?
Yeah, so I think in that structure that I've kind of created for myself, ideally if I've got 3 hours before the game, that's when I'm having like my last large meal. It's like 2:45 before the game. At 3 hours before, I'm usually doing some type of like moderate activation, some band work, some mobility, some stretching. I have my large meal 3 hours before, or 2.5 hours before. And then I have about an hour in the room before we would head down to the court. And, you know, in that hour, I'm going through my routine of getting ready. But then I'm also going through, you know, my mental routine to get prepared to get to the court. And that involves some visualization, some meditation. And I have some mantras I'm repeating to myself. As anchors that I use during the game. We go down to the courts about an hour before, and that kind of gives you 15 minutes of miscellaneous time down there before you have like a 45-minute warm-up before the game. So in an ideal situation, it usually goes like that all the time. But yeah, sometimes you don't get 3 hours before a game. Sometimes your first game's at 8 o'clock in the morning. So to do that at 5 a.m. is sometimes a little bit challenging. Sometimes breakfast doesn't open till 7 a.m. So that's when you really have to be adaptable.
Yeah. And what are some, what's the biggest mistake you have made preparing for a game in your career?
I wouldn't say that it's like a huge mistake, but I think probably the most common mistake for people is either underactivating or overactivating before the game. I think for the longest time, I overactivated. I really thought I needed a really long warm up, and I really needed to be like serving bombs and crushing balls before I started the game in order to be ready. And then when we got down to these third sets or the second match of the day or, you know, the third day of the tournament, all that extra energy that was put into that sometimes might not have been paying dividends at that point. But I think at the same time, there's athletes who underactivate and then they start really slow the game. So I think you have to find that comfortable medium for me. Like I know now I'm pretty comfortable with attacking, you know, between 8 to 10 balls and starting a game. Mm-hmm. Like if we're playing the second game of the day, if I hit 8 balls over the net, I'm good to go, coupled with all of the other things I'm doing warm up. But I don't need to be siding out for 15 minutes or 20 minutes before the game. So I think until I matured, my biggest, you know, problem with warm up was definitely overactivating. Like I felt like I'd already played a game by the time I started this game.
Which I guess could be okay if you're only playing one game, but if you play multiple in a short amount of time, that becomes a bigger problem. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of the Imperfect Athlete Podcast. My conversation with Sam continues in the next episode. Between then, you can find me on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, as JWK Mental Performance Training, or go to jwkmentalperformance.com for more information on my work and more content that I'm putting it out. Remember, stay home and stay safe, and I'll see you in the next episode.